Namaskaram. My name is Nayad. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come, follow me for a breakfast you will never forget. Namaste. Because you are going to make an incredible masala dosa under the watchful eye of my mom.
Kya baat hai, mom?
Each home adds their special touches. But not everyone gets to join in a traditional family meal. You will if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com. And don't just travel, explore.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and the final episode of our four-part specialist series, Expeditia. If you're playing this episode without having listened to the first three in the series, I'd strongly recommend you turn this off right now and go back and listen to those. This final episode came as a bit of a surprise to me. When Charlie got released from prison and finally arrived back in the UK, he woke up in the night and couldn't get back to sleep. Rather admirably, he made the decision to make one final recording. How was he feeling now? How had the experience changed him? And that, without any fancy frills, is episode 4. But before we kick this finale off, I just wanted to make a cheeky request for some feedback on this series. Personally, I've absolutely adored this process. Orla, who produces the podcast, did the bulk of the work, going through Charlie's recordings, ordering them, cutting them down, then helping me prepare for the long interview. But the result is not our standard adventure podcast. I'll continue doing those normal features because I love them too, and at the core of it, that's what this is. But this series has been something really different. Projects and series like this take a lot more work than the normal podcast, and I actually listened back to all of them to quality control them and got totally lost and immersed in the story, which I hope says a lot. I also owe Charlie a massive thank you. Without his commitment to the process, we wouldn't have anywhere near as interesting a final story. To keep a recorder going in your pocket in Russia during a police interrogation is pretty committed. So ultimately my point is, if you have any feedback, good, bad, whatever you want to say, please email me personally at matt@theadventurepodcast.co.uk with some feedback, or you can get in touch on Instagram @theadventurepodcast. If you are enjoying this style of podcast, then I'm up for uncovering some stories before the trips happen and making more series like this in the future. Okay, I hope you enjoy this final episode of the series, and thanks very much for listening.
And when you got home, you know, I didn't ask you to do this because I didn't feel like I could or should. But you recorded something when you got home.
Yeah. I think I left it 2 or 3 days. I can't remember. And it was just on my to-do list, but I didn't have time and wanted to put it off, I think. And God knows what I said.
Well, that was my question, is do you remember and could you bear to listen to it?
I'm sure I could bear to listen to it. I know for a fact that we don't have the studio time now, so you can't force me to listen to it and watch me do so. But I recorded it. I didn't sleep very well the first couple of nights back, probably time difference as much as anything else. You know, I was at one point 10 hours ahead of UK time. And so I recorded it at, I think, 4:30 in the morning for, oh, I don't know, like an hour. It was a long old, mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, I'm sure I could bear to listen to it, and I'm sure I will at some point. It would be interesting to do so, but what I said, I have no idea.
Yeah, it's going to form most of the final episode, just to break that to you now.
Oh, dear. Right. Well, sorry to everyone and anyone that was disgusted or offended by anything I said.
Oh, yeah, that lot. Don't read the comments.
Charles, man of Kuyga interview. Yes or no?
Well, it's a month since my last recording, and I'm home, and quite a lot has happened. And due to the nature of what happened, I have been entirely unable to make any recordings in the last month. The last time I recorded, I was just about to go into the office of the FSB in Tixie, having heard that they were sort of interested in me and what I was doing and why I was there, and I thought it'd be wise to get ahead of it and go and, you know, see them, show that I've nothing to hide. I went to see them and was there for, I think, about 2.5 hours, and in the end it was absolutely fine. There was very little to... There was no problem. They were just, I think, curious about me, but exhibited that curiosity in quite a sort of aggressive, interrogative manner. So I was done with them and very relieved about the whole thing. And the following day in Tixie, I was in the apartment I'd rented, and there was suddenly a knock at the door, and it was the police, not the FSB, but the regular police. And I didn't really know what they wanted, but they said, come with us. And I said, why? And they said, registration. And I thought, well, registration, that's all right. You know, I can register. I can hardly sort of refuse to register, because that seems like a sort of a straightforward thing that they might ask a tourist to do. And being uncooperative is never ideal. So down we went to the station, and after a while, they slowly conceded that, after having asked a few questions about me, they conceded that it was going to be difficult to continue without a translator, so they fetched a school teacher, English teacher, Olga, who spoke decent English. And over the following few hours, slowly it became clear that I was being lined up for another fine, like in Oosterkwiga, and the sort of grounds were being prepared to accuse me once again of conducting illicit journalism within Russia. They asked me who I'd met in Tixie, who I'd spoken to, and I saw it would be unwise to say that I hadn't met people who I'd been seen in public with. So I said, oh, I've met this guy called and I had lunch with him. I met him on the road while I was hiking, and he helped me find somewhere to stay. And they said, anyone else? And I said, well, I also met this guy called who asked to show me around Tixie, so I met him last night and he briefly showed me around. And that's it. And then they spoke amongst themselves for a while, and then they started asking me questions. Who are these people? And they clearly didn't know either of these two guys. And then there was a slightly awkward pause for 10 minutes or 20 minutes where the officer, writing up his notes, wouldn't answer any questions, wouldn't even address himself to me, although I had my questions translated to him. He was completely silent. And eventually he said, these witnesses say that you spoke about the war in Ukraine and that you were asking inappropriate questions. And I said, but you don't know who they are, and you haven't met them, and you haven't left the room, and you haven't made any phone calls. So how do you know what they said? And then the man went silent again. Anyway, so to cut that story a little shorter, about 2 hours later, so perhaps 5 hours after I was taken to the police station, I was taken to the court, having denied all accusations and refused to sign papers saying that I was a journalist. I was taken to court, and this was now at about 9:30 at night, or perhaps a bit later, and they had dragged in a judge who was the spitting image of Harry Redknapp, And this man came in his black robed gown, and the translator Olga was still there, but increasingly furious because she was meant to be preparing some things with her daughter for a sort of cake sale the next day to raise money for someone local who had blood cancer. And she had been dragged into the police station for as many hours as I had. And during the court case, which was pretty brief, she became increasingly sort of surly, I suppose, and translated things less and less fully. I would speak for a paragraph and she would say a curt sentence. The judge would talk for a minute and she would give me 15 seconds of translation. I wasn't offered a lawyer. I didn't understand much of what was said and what went on, but after a trial and a deliberation in total of about 45 minutes, I suppose, and after having denied quite stridently everything that was put to me, I was found guilty, and the sentence was handed down that I would have a fine of 5,000 rubles, or about £50, so that's no problem, and that I would be banned from Russia for 5 years, and that I would have to leave Russia very quickly. And although none of that's ideal, it wasn't the end of the world, so I didn't make a massive fuss. I thought, right, well, I'll pay £50 fine. I will get down to Yakutsk, I will find a flight, and I'll go home. So I signed the papers, I went back to the flat where I was staying, and then about half an hour later, there was a knock at the door. And there were police there, and they said, right, pack everything. Pack all your things. You've got your flight to Yakutsk tomorrow, so pack all your things, and you're staying in the police station tonight. And sure enough, in 15 minutes later, I'd hastily packed up all my stuff, which was in a bit of a sort of state, whatever was lying out and about in the flat, I just hid, anything that could be sort of further incriminating, I suppose. Packed it all up and suddenly found myself being fingerprinted in the old-fashioned way with ink rollers and then put in a sort of small concrete windowless cell for the night, which wasn't much fun, but it was, by the time they actually got me into the cell, it was about 1:30 at night and I was exhausted, so I went to sleep, woke up the next morning and was taken to some office by the marshals, essentially, the FSSP. I think they're sort of the bailiff's men, the equivalent of US marshals is how they described themselves. I was in their custody all day, and then I was taken to the airport, checked in with an escort, a marshal, who was a real, quite an unpleasant guy, a bit of a bully. He kept sort of prodding and nudging me and saying, look, stand here, do this, do that. And, nothing was quite right for him. Anyway, we flew down to Yakutsk, where I'd sort of thought, they've got me down to Yakutsk, I'll book a flight and I'll go home, and that's that. And on arrival at the airport in Yakutsk, there was another marshal waiting to meet us. And I was a couple of friends, local friends from Yakutsk, had come to meet me at the airport, also not really understanding what was happening. And so I had to entrust a bunch of my kit, everything except a sort of a small bag with valuables and some clothing. I gave all my kit to my friends and suddenly found myself in a minibus on my way to a detention centre. And it was at this point that the Yakutsk-based marshal, who spoke decent English, he confirmed, you are under arrest, you do know that, don't you? And I didn't really know that, because although I'd been to court and been found guilty, I'd been found guilty of another administrative offence, not a criminal charge. Anyway, he said, yeah, you're going to the detention centre for foreigners and you'll stay there until your deportation. And half an hour later, I was being processed into what they call a detention centre for foreigners, but what in every other sense is a prison. And all my items were checked into a locker. My shoelaces were removed so I couldn't hang myself or strangle any other inmates. And carrying just a few items of clothing, I was marched into this cell. The windows were barred. There were four rickety metal bunk beds and two other inmates. And suddenly the door was being slammed shut behind me, and the little hatch opened, the hatch through which food is normally passed, hatch in the door, and the face appeared saying, "Okay, so this is where you stay now, and if you, you know, if you have any problems, knock on the door." And I said, "You know, I'm not meant to be here. I'm just a tourist. I haven't done anything wrong." And they, being mildly acquainted with my case, I suppose, said, "Oh, don't worry, it's all just political." Which wasn't that reassuring, because, I mean, it's easy to say that if you're on the other side of the door, but I was the one locked up in the room. Anyway, to probably cut things a little bit shorter, I don't want to rabbit on forever, I was there for the last 4 weeks. It was a long, frightening, frustrating, an incredibly boring experience. The first 2 weeks, I was sharing the cell with a Ukrainian and a Kyrgyz man. The Ukrainian had committed some sort of criminal offence and had been in prison for the last 2 years and was now seeing out a six-month sentence in the detention centre, which from now on I'll just call the prison, before being deported to Ukraine. The Kyrgyz man had been caught working without a work permit, and so he was going to be deported to Kyrgyzstan. And the prison was 24 hours a day in the same room, with the exception of three times a week on Monday, Wednesday and Friday, when we were taken into the corridor and, under the supervision of a guard, given access to our phones for 15 minutes. So 15 minutes, three times a week, each week I had collectively 45 minutes in a panicked hurry to find out what's happening with my case, to make contact with loved ones, and to try and get myself out of there. It took a few days to arrange a lawyer, or when I say arrange, everything was done on my behalf. At the point I was put into the prison, from then onwards, I had to just allow friends and family to do what they could for me and basically sit back and try to wait patiently. But a judge was procured who arranged for an appeal, and the plan was to appeal not the conviction that had been levelled at me of conducting journalism, but to appeal the decision to quote-unquote forcibly deport me, as opposed to me self-deporting, i.e. let me just book a flight and go home myself, as opposed to waiting for the state to book a flight at their convenience to a country from which there are no flights from Russia, to which there are no flights from Russia because of a war going on and a huge mass of sanctions. It took 2 weeks for my appeal to be heard by a judge who looked over the huge stack of information put before him, the witness testimonies from people both inside and outside of Russia, the sort of character statements, I should say. And we didn't press the point that I was never even given a judge for my initial trial, and that I was clearly only there because some kangaroo court with some sort of cowboy judge in a remote coastal town had chosen to make an example of me, or tried to make themselves seem big or successful or something like that. The judge deliberated for about 2 minutes and said, "Your appeal is rejected. the reason being that your offences are so grave. And then he cited the fact that another accusation that I hadn't even been aware of was that I had apparently been photographing sensitive military sites in Tixie. So I was taken back to the cell. So that was after 2 weeks. The first 2 weeks, I didn't set foot outdoors. I was just stuck in the cell, in the prison, round the clock, every day. So the trip to the court, I suppose, at least got me outdoors for a couple of minutes at either end of the drive. The drive, I was handcuffed, and then so my hands were handcuffed together, and then my handcuffed hands were handcuffed to a police officer who had a taser. Another police officer with another taser flanked me on the other side. So back to the prison, where I had to wait another 2 weeks until finally, through quite a lot of hard work and diplomacy from people to whom I will be forever indebted at both the UK embassy and at home, I was included on a deportation run where three other prisoners and myself were deported. The others were all deported at the Russian state's expense, but the way we managed to get me onto that deportation was by booking my own ticket to coincide with the other deportation via Moscow. The next chance that I would have had to be deported was mid-July, so a further 2 months on, and had that not worked out, then it would have been the autumn, so I would have spent, I suppose, 5+ months in that cell. The second 2 weeks in the prison, I was in a cell by myself, which I frankly preferred. By that point, friends had managed to bring me a handful of English language books, so I spent all day reading and pacing lengths of my small cell. I could get 9 shuffling paces corner to corner, so I would pace hundreds of lengths each day, you know, sort of every day from 500 to 1,000 lengths of the cell, and do lots of sit-ups and push-ups and whatever I could to basically pass the time and try and keep myself relatively fit. The last day I was in there, I did 700 sit-ups, which was sort of absurd. I think the last 4 days collectively was 2,000 sit-ups. Anyway, I was finally deported. I was taken to the plane in handcuffs. In Moscow airport, I was suddenly put through another very thorough and grueling baggage search and security process, during which my journal, that had quite a lot to say about the state of Russia, was read through, and my camera was scrutinised again. The police had already hacked my phone in Yakutsk and, you know, looked through everything, as well as the state ordering the local TV news channel to do a news bit about me. So I was dragged in front of a camera in handcuffs and questioned about my offences in Tixie in not the most sort of rigorously balanced journalistic manner, and dragged on TV. The British Embassy later told me that I could potentially press for a human rights violation there, because you're not allowed to you know, drag on TV and humiliate foreign prisoners or any prisoners. So that last baggage search in Moscow airport went on for about an hour and a half, during which I became increasingly convinced I was going to miss my flight. I was eventually escorted to the gate just minutes before takeoff, so it was very touch and go. The flight, finally, those wheels taking off from the runway in Moscow was... Well, throughout this whole thing, this whole nightmare month, the nightmare I just couldn't seem to wake up from, I never knew what was coming next. I didn't know until a couple of days before I was going home that I was going home. I had hoped that my appeal would work and that I'd be free after that, but that didn't happen. On arrival, I thought I'd be there a night or two, and then I was told it'll be at least 10 days until the bailiffs send the documents through from Tixie. So I thought, right, 10 days, I can stay 10 days, I can stay 10 days. And then I got my appeal week, 2 months, okay, maximum 2 months, that's fine, then I can go. And by the time I was actually released, I had sort of come to think that I might be there for a really long amount of time, and I'd sort of given up hope. And the not knowing was the worst aspect. Each day, I had no idea if that would be my last day or if I was only 5% of the way through my time in that place. And that was very frustrating and frightening. And I, all the while, had this terrible fear that they would suddenly start, you know, use me to make an example or as a bargaining chip internationally in some sense. It's not like the British and Russian governments are on at all friendly terms at the moment. And some stupid, clumsy, unsuspecting tourist who wandered into a military area or a former military area seemed like a, you know, perfect bargaining chip. One thing that feared me is scared me, was on arrival in the prison in Yakutsk. The following day, I was handcuffed and taken into a cell where the police had laid out every item that I had with me. So my camera, my GoPro, I'd hidden the voice recorder, and my journal I'd slipped in the back of my shirt and taken into the cell with me, where I kind of hid it in plain sight. You're not allowed metal items in the cell. There's a search every morning. They get a bunch of guards come in with metal detectors and basically turn the entire cell upside down and check the bars of the cage, check inside the cupboards, check inside the cistern of the toilet, and scan our bodies with metal detectors. But the journal seemed innocuous enough. But everything that had been in my locker was laid out on the table in this room where a police officer asked me about it all. And he clearly thought that my camera was a professional camera and that my GoPro was a spy camera. And I had a GPS device, which to Russian people looked very suspect because GPS is almost synonymous with spies. Spion, international spion was two words that one of the guards used in reference to me, international spy. But among all the stuff laid out on that table was a plug adapter from Russian to British sockets, in the back of which I'd unscrewed, and inside, wrapped up in white paper to make it less visible, I'd secreted some micro SD cards with all my recordings on from the voice recorder, including that recording where I was taken into a police station in Ust-Kuyga. And just because my recorder was on me when the police came to the door and I'd slipped it in my pocket, I had a recording of being sort of interviewed, questioned by the police, particularly after they had taken my phone and turned it off to make sure I couldn't record anything. But there was also just lots and lots I said in those recordings that was far from glowing about Russia and the war in Ukraine, which all along I had been, to police at least, claiming to know little about, to be apolitical, to have no interest in. And so this whole time I was in that cell thinking, you know, when are they going to step this up? When is this going to become a criminal investigation? When are they going to formally accuse me of being a journalist intent on spreading lies about the Spetsialnaya Operatsiya in Ukraine? The sentence for spreading misinformation about the military in Russia was put up to, the maximum possible sentence was increased to 15 years in March. So there was suddenly a very real possibility that I might end up spending a chunk, a wedge of my adult life in a Russian prison. So when finally I got on that plane, that Emirates flight via Dubai back home, of course, no direct flights, the plane took off, and throughout this whole ordeal, throughout the whole month, throughout the hurried calls with my girlfriend, and the minutes immediately following each of those, especially on Friday before the long weekend with 72 hours until the next phone call, I never once cried. I felt very close to it a number of times. I was overwhelmed with, despair at times, helplessness, anger, depression. But I never let it fully collapse me into a state of blubbering tears. which is something that I can get into a lot more easily these days. I think since my dad died, I find it a lot easier to get sort of weepy. I'm a lot more prone to breaking down in that respect. The day I got news that my grandmother had just died, which was about 3 weeks into my time in the prison, I heaved a couple of sort of gentle sobs, but choked it down and swallowed it. But on that plane, the plane took off, and suddenly, before I knew what was happening, I was just in floods of tears, and I had to stumble half-blind down the aisle before the seatbelt thing had been turned off, shut myself in the loo, sit down, and just bawl. And I think that was just the final release, the build-up of everything that had come before. So I got home. I've been back a full day now. It's currently about 4:30 in the morning. I can't get back to sleep. There's just a lot, I suppose, to process. There's a lot for me to find out about what happened while I was inside. I don't just mean in the wider world, but I mean with my case. I was the last person to know about everything, really, because, you know, my loved ones could be, you know, collaborating with the lawyer and with the UK embassy and sort of campaigning, doing what they could to get me out of there. And I would always be the last to know, or don't know yet, because, you know, there was so little time in which to impart information to me on my brief, hurried phone calls, which were very businesslike because there was always a lot to get through. I'm back home. I've been totally flat out since I got back, with, you know, 3 months of unanswered emails to catch up on and life and work to arrange. And I've yet to sort of broach social media and make my first post in 3 months since leaving Yakutsk. Obviously, social media was blocked in Russia as soon as the war began. Yeah, I just don't really know what to think about it all yet. I've definitely still got a lot of anger. I mean, that was the worst thing in the cell, was just anger and boredom. And I got bored with how angry I was, and I got angry about how bored I was. Certainly until the books came along, I had just nothing to do. It was desperately boring. I would just stare at the ceiling round the clock. And then I, over the following sort of, you know, 3 weeks, I read 7,000 pages of books. I think about 11 books were delivered to me, one of which I read twice. I read a 1,000-word book twice in a 2-week period, which is sort of mad. Also, it was a fantasy adventure book, not the sort of thing I tend to read. And I think it's time management feels really difficult now. You know, I've had so little to manage, to control, to marshal in my life for a month, and then very relatively little for 2 months before that, where my day-to-day was, you know, wake up, avoid freezing to death during breakfast, put on boots and start walking. At the end of the day, put up a tent and go back to sleep. So I do feel a little kind of like a deer in the headlights at the moment. And it'll, I'm sure, take time to settle back in. And with regard to Russia and my 5-year ban, I am not at all fussed by that. You know, I wouldn't go back if I was paid to. Or certainly not before the world sees a regime change and or Vladimir Putin strung up from a lamppost. I don't think I will ever feel safe going back to Russia again. But anyway, that's me wittering on half asleep at 4:30 in the morning for half an hour. But, yeah, a fairly horrific, anxiety-inducing end, Kafka-esque end, to what was otherwise a fascinating and sort of wonderful adventure up in the Arctic.
What do you do with it now? I hate the what next question. It bores me. But what do you do now with this?
I'm going to start scribbling and write a book about this journey, which I hope can be or should be more than just a travel log. You know, I think there's insight and issues that I had some exposure to that hopefully can be valid as well as just interesting, I hope. But that does sound like delusions of grandeur. I've given one already presentation about, you know, slideshow, which I hastily put together on the train on the way to the venue. And there are a couple of Ukrainians in the audience. That was really interesting. But it was a primary school age audience. So trying to pitch some of these ideas when you haven't even yet really formed them to sort of, you know, 8 to 12-year-olds or whatever was interesting. But yeah, I mean, I've got a story. It's my story, but hopefully it's not all about me. And I will tell it as best I can.
And regardless of mine or your view on reality or politics, if there was regime change and it felt safe to do so, would you go back?
Absolutely. But that would have to be a change of politics and ideology as opposed to just Putin snuffs it or someone snuffs him and, you know, Medvedev takes over or whoever. I'm only banned for 5 years, but, you know, I've not hidden my feelings about Russia since I've got back, and it would be foolish for me to go back while anything like the current status quo stands.
Yeah. And as you might know, I always end every podcast with two questions.
I knew you were going to do this, and I planned to come up with some sort of answer, and I haven't.
Your face just then was amazing. Oh, it was genuine fear. But it feels
I
even
listened
though
to a crap
is...
podcast on my cycle right here. I could have thought of something to say to you.
Is it on mine?
No.
Yeah. Even though this is a series, I think it's as relevant as it ever is. What scares you?
Russia. Now. Boredom. How many answers am I allowed? Age.
Many as you like.
Getting a hairy back.
I'm there.
Dangerous wildlife, heights. Although I love climbing, but I think it's foolish not to be afraid of heights. Yeah, plenty of things scare me. I'm by no means fearless. There's lots. I think boredom is probably the admittedly slightly wanky but headline answer to that.
Age was an interesting one.
Well, it's not necessarily age. I'm happy to get older, but I've already got pretty dodgy knees and shoulders, and it's, I suppose, maybe not age, but decrepitude. Is that one of those words you're no longer allowed to say? I'm not really sure.
If it is, Orla will take it out.
I fear not being able to move and hike and climb and swim and do the things that I like doing.
What brings you hope?
That I'm really struggling. I think I'm quite a hopeful person. I draw hope from, I suppose, art and literature and natural beauty and many of the same things that I guess many people do. That's quite a cop-out as an answer, though, isn't it?
Most people say kids.
Kids. Oh, I haven't got those. And the ones I see often don't give me any hope. Little shitbags, aren't they? In a literal sense, when they're young, that is.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Definitely the case. Yeah.
Good luck with yours.
Thanks.
To look at it from that perspective, the next generation, the fact that younger people in this country at least seem to be a lot more, or at least the ones that you hear about and see, seem to be a lot more engaged and worried about and active with problems that people a generation above us are all too often happy to ignore, that hopefully gives you hope. But that is hope in the face of a lot of looming, impending disaster with regards to climate and social issues and all sorts. So you know, ask about this for a parting sentence. Hope is always tempered.
You're such a cynic.
Well, I won't deny that. I am more cynical than I would like to be.
You said it, not me. I'm just repeating it. Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to Expeditia, a four-part specialist series with Charlie Walker. For more information on the podcast in general, visit theadventurepodcast.co.uk. The podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft and is produced and edited by Orla O'Murray, who needs a particularly special thank you for this series, where she did a huge amount of work. If you want to get in touch, as I've mentioned throughout this series in the intros and outros, you can do so at info@theadventurepodcast.co.uk or matt@theadventurepodcast.co.uk, and I'll pick those up personally. You can also get in touch on Instagram @theadventurepodcast. And finally, if you've enjoyed this series, please do leave us a specific review commenting on the series in general. It really helps other people to find the podcast and navigate what it is they want to listen to. And it helps with SEO and iTunes and Spotify, gets us up the list and helps other people to access this podcast. So thank you in advance.